everyone. Welcome to Made for Music. I am your host, Duncan Byerjohn. The reason I started this podcast was growing up, music was my ultimate passion, but I didn't know how to get started. So this podcast seeks to depict a comprehensive view of the music world, from the artistry to the business, so you can discover the resources available to you, and most importantly, the stories behind the people making things happen. If you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. I truly appreciate that extra effort. Without further ado, here is the next episode of Made for Music. Hey everyone, this is another episode recorded pre-coronavirus. That said, Taylor's story is truly incredible. It was so uplifting. Even just editing this podcast was such a message and feeling of positivity that I really think the world could use right now. As well, there's just some amazing information for musicians looking to tour, juxtaposing DIY touring with that through an agency. Vaudeville Etiquette also just released a single, Fever Dream, which is so good. So I highly recommend you check that out. That's actually what's playing underneath this VO right now and will be playing at the end of the episode. Be strong out there. Much love. Without further ado, here is the next episode of Made for Music. Welcome to Made for Music. Today's friend of the podcast was a triple threat from a young age, heavily involved with dance, piano, and musical theater, pretty much living and breathing performance around the clock. Inspired by the likes of Stevie Nicks, Aretha Franklin, George Harrison, and other songwriting and vocalist greats, she founded Vaudeville Etiquette, a band that sounds just as much country as it does Seattle and rock and roll, expertly blending Western grooves with intricate vocal work and evocative lyrics. They have since gone on to release 2 full-length albums, 2 EPs, just recently dropped a great new single, and have generated over 1 million plays on Spotify alone and toured the United States and Europe. So without further ado, please welcome a DIY touring guru, phenomenal vocalist, songwriter, and trained Reiki master, Taylor Lynn.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I guess if we go all the way back to the beginning, how did music and the arts play into your life growing up?
Music has always kind of been the cornerstone of my life. It was always playing in my house growing up. It was always something that I could go to whenever I was, you know, coping with things or feeling lonely or dealing with the trauma that every child deals with in their childhood. I always was able to find a home in music. And whether that was just, you know, going through my parents' record and CD collection or being on stage in musical theater, it was always just felt like a very safe place and like a very sacred home for me. So yeah, I started playing piano and dancing at a young age. Hated practicing.
Of course. Yeah. You have to as a child.
Right. I wanted the results, but I didn't want the process. Really kind of started taking it seriously in high school. I had friends that were, budding songwriters and incredible musicians that ended up just being really inspiring. And from there, I just started. It was kind of that thing where, like, you see your friends do it and you're like, oh, well, I can do that too. If they can do it, I can do it. So I started, I picked up a guitar and I started writing my own songs and would use it as an excuse when I wouldn't get invited to parties. I'd be like, well, I'm just going to sit in here and write my songs. Yeah. I'll save the parties for later. And it ended up working out. I kind of just feels like it's been my buddy forever, and I can still always rely on it.
What kind of stuff were you listening to growing up, and then as you transitioned into a songwriter, was that consistent or did that change?
It was all over the place, which makes a lot of sense in hindsight because I like to write all over the place. I really loved listening to a lot of jazz standards. I remember Frank Sinatra died when I was in 7th grade and I cried and wrote a paper. About it. And of course everyone in my class was like, "Frank who?"
Yeah.
I grew up with a single mom and a sister, and my mom was huge into Lilith Fair and, you know, all of these like great singer-songwriters, of female singer-songwriters from the 90s. And so that, you know, Sarah McLachlan, Katie Lang, Indigo Girls, like all of that Lilith Fair scene was kind of the soundtrack of a lot of my formative years. So I really liked a lot of standards and a lot of classic stuff. And then I also really liked a lot of, you know, contemporary female forward singer-songwriter stuff, and then everything in between, like show tunes for days. Like, it just didn't really matter. So yeah, I was just really open to everything. I went through a grunge phase. I had a huge appetite for music.
And how did being involved in so many other forms of art influence that, or did that influence that eclectic taste?
Yeah, I would say that it gave me access to a lot of different things that I wouldn't normally find on my own. And within that access, it also gave me like a context to kind of fall in love with so many different things, and meeting so many different people, and experiencing music from a different angle. You know, when you're dancing, you experience the music in your body. When you're, you know, playing piano, that's also like a very tactile way of doing it versus just kind of passively listening. So I felt like it really kind of ingrained, you know, the DNA of music within my bones at a very early age.
Is that involved in, I'm going to mispronounce it again,
Reiki?
did that like inspire you? Because it sounds, what I understand about it is it's very much like healing through kind of, well, I'll let you explain it.
you're there. You're right there. Yeah, it's energy work. And it absolutely 100% is connected to music and performance for me. When I step on stage and I am performing to a room, any performer is manipulating the energy of that room. Like, they are there to make you feel different than you did when you walked in. Could be anything, but you're going to feel change by their performance, right? And so that's energy work in the same vein as Reiki. And I knew that I was always really sensitive to that, and I was always really capable of doing that in a way that came really naturally to me. But I didn't really understand how to use it beyond a performance context. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered Reiki, it just started giving me a vocabulary and a context for work that I was already doing and already knew how to do, but it allowed me to take kind of that same template and that same approach and apply it to healing, which has been a really rewarding and very cool kind of offshoot of performing that I never anticipated kind of stumbling into, but I absolutely love it.
Oh, so cool. Has that influenced how you perform or how you write at all since?
100%. Yes. So when you're doing Reiki, you're accessing what's called like universal love energy, which is just like that feeling you get when you're like staring at your pet or your loved one and you just like get really warm and everything's suddenly okay. That's an energetic frequency. And I think that's also something that any artists, musicians included, you're trying to get there with your music and with your art. So everybody's trying to access the same point. It's just a matter of finding the point of access that works for you. So I like to work with performers that maybe aren't familiar with the healing side of that energy work, and kind of show them how to get there that way, but also work with non-performers that maybe don't understand how to access it through a performance place. So for me, there's definitely an intersection, and that intersection is what I'm most excited about. But it absolutely influences both my performance and my work, because when people talk about like tapping into like this creative pool, that's the same thing too. So it's this place of like acceptance and love and non-judgment, and that's where creativity is like flourishing, right? And same thing with performance. Like when you're on stage and you're looking at your band and everyone is just like completely locked in with one another and you have this moment of like transcendence where everyone's floating and like time slows down and, you know, it's just amazing. Same thing. Like it's all the same thing. It's just different ways of approaching it. And it doesn't have to be like spooky and mystical and woo woo. It's just a part of who we are. And it's a reason why we're artists or we love to consume art. So yeah, it's really just about like finding how all of those things are related, demystifying it, and then just showing people the ways that they can access it. So
this is coming from a super ignorant place. Is that something that like you communicate with the band to get to a spot like that?
I would say I'm definitely doing some Reiki without telling them, but it's good. It's not a manipulative thing.
Right, yeah.
And there were, you know, plenty of years where I think a little bit of energy balance would have helped us in certain times. But yes, the band knows that I'm a healer and they know the work that I do, but I guess I don't really like force it upon them if they don't want it. But I also know that they're stoked on it and they benefit from the things that I can bring and the ways that I can access things. And it's mostly in just how I show up for myself, you know, and how I'm able to let things go in a way that I wasn't able to before. And just really come from a place of like, loving non-judgment. I think when you want something so bad, which I did, you know, when we started off, it's really easy to hold on to it so tight that you end up strangling it and you end up, you know, like isolating people or not listening to opinions and you can really self-sabotage in that way. And we ran into that. I think every young band does. But I will say that like after kind of finding having these revelations of like understanding that it's all connected, it takes a little bit of the pressure off and it makes it a bit more of a harmonious dynamic between all of us.
Jumping back to you all getting together, you met some of the folks up here in Seattle.
Yeah, I actually went to music school up here then. Yeah. That's where I met Brad, the co-lead singer and songwriter. And we met in music school and I brought my sister in for a music project and the two of them, long story short, ended up falling in love, getting married. And the three of us, actually moved down to LA to, you know, live the dream and, you know, ended up living in, on top of each other in a one bedroom apartment, just like broke as all hell. And, you know, tried to get this band thing going. I was doing a lot of improv comedy, a lot of waiting tables. And it was really hard. It was really tough. It was really difficult to, as we were talking about before, like bring people out to a show because everyone else has a show of their own and everyone's just kind of starving from the same pool. And it was really hard to build a following. And we, you know, had kind of remembered leaving this really vital, robust music scene up here where not only musicians are really supportive of other musicians, it's kind of like we all rise together vibe, which was the opposite of what we found in LA, but also there is an appetite for a consumption of music here. Like there are people that don't care what they see, they just have to go see live music on the weekend. And those are a musician's favorite kind of people because you just want to get in front of them and show them what you got. So we ultimately, you know, made the decision to kind of cut our losses and move back up here. And then with the intention of fleshing out the band and building it into something that was larger than just a duo, which is what we were doing, kind of like a Civil Wars type, you know, just guy girl duet, which was, you know, all the rage at that time. So we came back, we built out the band through friends and Craigslist and coworkers and just kind of a hodgepodge of what ended up being like the perfect people that I still consider family to this day. So we got lucky.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
How long was that process? And I guess, what did you learn?
I would say it's a never-ending process. Like I said, we got really lucky right out the gate in just meeting some really great people. And I always say that it's so much like dating. Like, it's, you really are like courting each other and dating, and you know, ideally there's no sex involved, but that can happen too, but we won't get into that. But you have to understand not only how you work together in a creative capacity, but how you work together in a social capacity. I think one thing that a lot of musicians don't consider or struggle with is the idea of commitment. And it was really difficult. We would play with a lot of really great players that were in like eight other bands, like the polyamorous musician, right? And it was hard. And we ended up with the touring schedule that we wanted and the gusto that we wanted to approach our work. We needed people that would be our, like our primary players. And we had to say goodbye to a couple people just for that reason. And it's difficult, but they are out there. And I think it's just like dating, where like you have to find the people that believe in the same common cause and just hope that everybody's like ready to strap in and go for it.
You mentioned touring as well. What was that roadmap like?
Yeah, I would say we had to start really small because we didn't have a lot. So what we started off with was a plan to make an EP, and the EP was going to be five songs. And initially we thought we'll make one EP, we'll gig on it, then we'll make another EP, then we'll combine it as a full length. And then we just had all of these really lofty plans. And luckily it didn't end up working out like that, but we made an EP, and we started to get a little bit of traction and booking from that EP, and just in local places around Seattle, small rooms and coffee shops and things like that. And we just kept playing. I was in school at the time, and one of the adjunct professors at the university that I was going to was Barrett Martin, who is the drummer for Screaming Trees. And so I was in his class. I admittedly, sorry, Barrett, didn't know who he was. but I knew Screaming Trees, and I knew that he was, established in that Seattle scene, and ended up just really liking him. I think I invited him out to a show, and he came out. We were playing like the Blue Moon on like a Thursday or something. And he came out and really liked it, and was starting to recruit other artists for the label that he was putting together, which he had, he had a few artists on it, but it was mostly a vehicle for him to release the stuff that that he was doing, which was fantastic. And so it was really when like kind of Barrett came onto the project that things really started to take off. And I think that that's a really important thing to stress, because a lot of times like these trajectories can seem really effortless, but it's really, really important to make the connections and to find the people that are at least, you know, one to five steps ahead of you, or have, you know, the contacts or the wherewithal to be able to open doors for you that you wouldn't otherwise do. And honestly, I don't think that you can do it any other way, unless you just have an extreme amount of patience and like a lifespan of like 300 years. Like, yeah. You really need to find those people that that believe in what you do and are positioned in places that can really help expedite what you're doing. And Barrett was that for us. And I also want to say, just a caveat, because I've listened to people say things like I'm saying, and I always think, well, that's impossible. It worked for you, but how am I going to go find like a guy that just happens to be starting a label that was in the scene, you know?
Yeah.
And you won't. That's the thing. Like, my experience is going to be completely different, but you will find someone else. And it, and you have, you just have to be open to the idea that like there isn't one way to do it, but you do it really, really is about the people that you know and the people that believe in you, and not in a smarmy way. Like, it's just about showing up, making those relationships and making those connections. So don't be discouraged by my story, I think is really important, because I spent a lot of time listening to people and be like, well, of course they could do that because they had this or they had that. You can also have exactly what you need, and you can find the contact that you absolutely need. But it's probably not going to be Barrett Martin, but it's going to be someone else. I just wanted to say that because I wish someone would have said that to me.
Well, that's a fantastic point. And what also seems apparent is that you all had a game plan so that when you met Barrett, it wasn't just like, oh, I want to do music. It was, you had the vision, you had the material, you're working towards something to where someone like that with the access can buy in. Yes. Versus just, I'm a great singer, why am I not getting picked up?
Right. Yeah. So. Like, come listen to me sing in my bedroom kind of thing. Yeah, we had an EP at that time, and we had a hunger to work and to, you know, so he really helped us. He produced our first record. He helped us, you know, book the studio time and the staff that were, you know, just a dream. Jack and Dino mixed our record, and you know, we got, you know, the great room at Avast, and just all of these things that we could have cold called and we could have tried to pull that off. But I would say that 99% of the cold calls that I still make, I never hear back from. So, mm-hmm. You know, you really have to have that liaison to get to those places that you need. And so from there, we put a full length record together, and it did incorporate, I think, every song that was on the EP. A lot of the stuff we retracked, but we used a lot of the stuff that we had originally recorded, which I'm really proud of. It was really cool. When it came time to release the full length, we had the support of Barrett's label and the support of his contacts, which also got us a publicist out of LA, which don't come cheap. So save your money, everyone. Yeah. and the deal that we had set up with the label was pretty much a distribution deal. So we didn't get any sort of budget or money to make the record. Everything that we paid for everything on our own, and we paid for everything just from gigging. We just played anywhere and everywhere that we could. We played, you know, weddings, we played private parties, we played, you know, whatever. And so we just self-financed the record. And then the deal was distribution on the back end. So we got a publicist, ended up having a really great rapport with him. He got us some really great press, and he actually helped us in setting up our first West Coast tour, which was the first extended tour that we had done. So while we were making the record and raising money, we were kind of just working in concentric circles where it was like, okay, we'll play Seattle. And once we, are getting traction in Seattle, then we work out, then we go down to Portland, and then we go to Eugene, and, you know, we go play in Winthrop, and we played weird places. Like, I don't know if you've ever been to the Brick in Roslyn, but that place is crazy, and you have to play for like 3 hours, and then you stay overnight in the bar up top, and they lock you in there, and it's a riot. But it also takes an incredible amount of physical and alcoholic fitness to endure. So we were playing all of the Pacific Northwest at that point, whereas anyone that, you know, wanted us to play, we would get in three cars and drive, you know, down to Bend or Salem or, you know, Eastern Washington. It didn't matter. But when we released the record, that was our plan. Our plan was to go as far south as San Diego and come all the way up. And we all had 9-to-5 day jobs at that point, and we just booked out 10 days and we're like, we're going to do this. I don't know how we're going to do this, but these are the 10 days that we're all not going to be working and let's see what happens. And that was the first tour. And that was with the help of our publicist, was all kind of booked by me. And it was a combination of begging people to help me book and just straight up cold calling and cold emailing. And just a lot of nail biting and stress eating and anxiously checking my email for months. But we did it. We pulled it off and we put it together and it was really great. And it was the first kind of taste of can we actually do this? And can we spend 10 days in a car together, you know, without killing each other? Can we spend 10 days in a car together without, you know, getting completely obliterated and, you know, just having too much fun?
Yeah.
which will happen. But yeah, it was kind of like the trial run and it went really well. And then I think we all kind of got home still, you know, best friends and closer than ever. And we all kind of got home and said like, okay, we did this and we know that we love this and let's keep doing it.
Was it the fastest 10 days of your life up to that point?
Yes. That's a whole nother, like tour time is a whole nother thing. It was fast, but also like you also feel like you've aged 10 years, but also you feel like a baby. Like it's weird. Like time and space do different things.
Energized, when you're on the road. Exhausted because you've had 3 hours of sleep.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I always talk about touring as being the closest thing to being a baby again, because you're literally carried to a place and then you get to play for 2 hours and then you're fed and then you're carried again to a bed and you sleep and then you wake up and you do it again. And like all of your adult responsibilities just kind of melt away and it's very weird. And if you're not prepared for it, it can really do strange things to your head because you finally have this opportunity to step outside of your life and look in at it. And it's hard. Touring's not for everybody. There's a lot of different elements that you, when you watch like Almost Famous or like, you know, all these great movies about touring artists, it looks so fun and glamorous and it is, but there's also so many things that you don't think you'll be confronted with that you are within like an hour of driving away.
A lot of the grit is either like way overemphasized or way just cut out.
Yeah, it's that's like a really good point. Yeah.
Shown in a realistic way, I don't think.
I don't think it should though, because there's a lot of really boring parts.
That is very true. Yeah. An 8-hour documentary on the drive from Portland to Boise might not be the most fun.
Just like people like sad talking to their boyfriends or girlfriends, like, yeah, I'm really tired.
Yeah.
I haven't eaten anything but chips in 4 days.
And then whispering because the cranky person finally fell asleep. So. But it's your one time to talk. You do this like 10-day run.
Yeah.
You've got like a new record out. You come back and you're like, all right, we're in this. What did the next steps look like?
Everything that we've done was just trial by error. And I think if you're an independent musician, you just have to get comfortable with throwing things at the wall and seeing if they'll stick. Even, you know, even if you listen to, you know, a million people telling you about their process, you're going to run into things where you finish them and then you're like, okay, what now? Because it's such an unconventional way of living and way of working where there's not one thing that's going to work for everyone. So there was a lot of what now when we got back. We had made some traction. We'd made really good contacts. But you know, because we were an independent band and we were self-financed, we all had to go back to work and we had then, you know, drained the band kitty. And so it was like, okay, now we start over again. And that's what we did. We just started raising more money and we started playing better shows. The record got really good reception. The tour did really well. And so that helped kind of push us up to another level. At that point, our goal was to play more festivals. We wanted to do that. And that seemed like a really good way of getting in front of a lot of people without having to, you know, travel and take all of that time off. And it's also just really fun. And it's a really good way to gain exposure to people that aren't even there for your show. And so we did that. Like we just played, we did our concentric circles of the Pacific Northwest. We played festivals. We continued to just make connections and build and build and build until, we had money to make the second record. And that, that's when, the process started all over again. So it wasn't a linear ramp, you know, like it wasn't like we got off our 10-day tour and then all of a sudden, you know, we were famous and we, you know, never had to ask to play a show ever again. We got off our 10-day tour and then we started back at the beginning, mm-hmm. but like with a little bit better, you know, a little bit smarter and a little bit like faster shoes or something, you know, right. And we raised more money and we were able to spend more money on the second record and do things that we had wanted to do or weren't able to do on the first. And that's right around the time that we were courted by the agency in Europe. And that came through a friend that we had met through playing festivals. And so again, like it's like a video game. Like mm-hmm. it's the whole thing is like you go into this room and you say this code word and this man gives you, you know, like an amulet and then like all of a sudden you can tour Europe. Like, and it's you don't know how to play the game until you're in the middle of it. You mm-hmm. just have to be open to whatever's going to come at you.
Totally.
So then we got connected with this agency that was looking to build their roster with more American bands and namely bands with women in them. Like the genre that Vaudeville Etiquette is in, which is, you know, like Americana, we can sometimes be lumped into like Southern rock, although I don't agree with that, but it's fine. We're all from Seattle, so I don't know. At the time, at least, I think there's more now, but I was never playing with women. Like it was always just me and a room full of like dudes with beards and flannels. No offense. that's actually where I feel
she
most comfortable.
She just described me basically, which is funny because it's like brand new gift for the new year. But I'm going to try on this flannel.
It's a good flannel.
Thank you.
So I think that also gave us, you know, we poked out a little bit kind of in the crowd because I was a woman in the band and I wasn't content on just being a backup singer. I can't.
Same.
I have to be louder and bigger and more obnoxious. Though I do like to sing backup, but I also need my spotlight. So we kind of created a niche in that. And it's not just, oh, there's a girl in the band niche. We wanted to do something a little bit different and we wanted to kind of turn things on its head. So we ended up kind of being the wild card for this agency that was, you know, booking like very like Lynyrd Skynyrd, like Southern rock bands. But then there was this kind of like breath of fresh air, which was us that in hindsight went really well. And people in Europe got really excited about because it was a little bit of a left field booking for them. Mm-hmm. And that again was just credit to like our friends that were able to say like, you got to check out this band. They're really great. And making that connection. And like you said, like meeting that person at the time where we were prepared because we were able to say to them, we have this first record, we've toured on it. Here, you know, here's a review in, Pace magazine. Here's a review in USA Today. Here's this and this and this. Oh, by the way, like we're working on the second record and wouldn't it be great to tour on it in Europe? So it was a good, a kind of a fortunate meeting of two people that were just really poised to work together. And yeah, that's how it happened.
That's so cool.
It sounds so much easier when I say it.
Well, we're skipping over months and months of work. But so it is interesting because you had been doing all the bookings yourself, correct? Mm-hmm. Up until you met that agency. So
yeah,
once you worked with the agency, what did you see the pros and cons? And then did that experience influence how you book now?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I was doing all the booking and the management and I'm sure musicians listening to this podcast will know, but the amount of admin work that is behind getting on stage and playing a show is ridiculous. I mean, it's so much, you know, it's not just sending emails to bookers. It's like taking care of the advances, taking care of the writers, making sure all the set lists are printed out, making sure the band knows like where to go, like how to get there, where to park, what are the drink tickets, like do we get food? Like there's just so many administrative hospitality things that when you're running a band by yourself take up so much time. And I was lucky in that, like at that time I had a desk job that didn't require a lot of my attention. And I was able to build the band there. I hope that my boss from there is now listening. I won't name the company. Yeah, I mean, you really have to, you've got to devote that time to doing that. And so when we signed on with this agency, I was incredibly excited to give up that part. And not because like, I like doing things like that. I like, you know, project managing and sorting through things like that, but I also love performing way more. And if I did those things and I approached them with such love and gusto because I knew at the end of the 7,000 emails, I was able to get on stage and dance around and do what I actually wanted to be doing. So it was a trade-off. And I would say that was the thing that I was most excited about when we signed on with the agency, was like, not having to make those cold calls, not having to beg or like wake up in the morning and be like, how do we play, you know, how do we play San Francisco? I don't know. Who do you know in San Francisco? Like,
yeah,
things like that, where you just have to pool all of your contacts, like knowing that someone had not only all of that taken care of, but a contact list of, you know, and a route that that I didn't have to just like build out of thin air.
Totally. When you went to Europe, how were the audiences different?
They're fantastic. Our first show we ever played was in Germany, and we were so nervous. And I remember the final note of the first song, and we're so used to like our shows have a real crescendo, and so we will take things in a really kind of quiet, moody place, and we like to just end with just like, we want your face to be melting off by the end. So we're used to like people, you know, like dancing around and drinking, and there people get in fights at our shows, which is so weird because we're singing about like, I love you. Yeah. But it happens. Yeah. We're not an aggressive band by any means, but I don't know. We're passionate. And so we're very used to, you know, like watching an audience kind of go from, you know, this kind of lovely introspection to, you know, like cutting a rug by the end of the night. And with that comes like a lot of noise and a lot of rowdiness and a lot of, you know, sometimes it shows like people aren't paying attention. They're in another world. And that used to really bother me, but now I really love it because you're at a show, do what you want to do. Our first show in Germany, the final note of the first song ended and there was complete silence for an excruciating 2 seconds. And I remember thinking like, well, this is it. Like, we'll never play Europe again. And in that 2 seconds, right after, like an uproarious applause came, and it was so relieving, but also just really beautiful because the audiences there are so intent and focused, and yeah. they're so, I don't know, it's like a, it's almost like a different level of comprehension of the music, or even just like a different way of approaching it, where they're just so involved. And we had people that would you know, we're coming to our shows having like watched all of our videos on YouTube. There are people singing the songs, and we're, you know, we're just some American band that's never been over there, and it wasn't Beatlemania, but like we didn't expect people to know the words to our songs.
Right.
So they were great. Like I love playing Europe for that reason. It's just like people are just really excited and really interested and curious about who we are and what we're doing, and they really end up loving it in a way that's different. It's mm-hmm. it's definitely different. I think there's a little bit more of a recklessness over here that is fine. It's just a different type of show.
Do you feel that because the sound does kind of have some of that like Americana vibe to it, that it's almost more eclectic over there, or is there a lot of that kind of music being emulated in Europe as well?
Yeah. I would say there's definitely a novelty to it. And I think that that was contributed to the level of excitement, because there are bands over there that are trying to do that. But it's just like, if I was like, I want to start like a Hungarian dance group, it would be like, okay, but you're not going to do it well.
Right. Yeah.
And it's probably not going to be like super authentic. And so, yeah, so there, I think there was a level of authenticity that we were able to bring, really without even knowing or doing anything that really helped us. And it's unfortunate sometimes too, because, and I thought about this a lot when I was over there, you know, we had people that would just come out because they wanted to see an American rock band. And it's a bummer, because I don't know anybody that would be like, there's a German rock band playing, we must go see that show.
Yeah,
you know, like,
that's real.
It sucks that it's a double standard, and it sucks that it's not kind of backwards compatible, but, it's nice to be on the good side.
Yeah, exactly. You go throughout Europe, or the agency handles a lot of it. When you come back here, were there things done a certain way? You're like, oh, I'm now going to alter my approach, or the band's an approach touring differently, even if it's DIY.
Yeah, I would say the main thing that was what we decided on when we got back was like, oh, we need to hire people. Like, this is not something that we should have to be doing all on our own, because it's so much nicer to have someone that is completely, you know, poised and built for that role, doing that role, so that you can be poised and built for the role that you're doing. It's not always easy, and I would say that we have had more success in hiring staff in Europe than we have here. I think just because of that kind of novelty. And I think that's another real key point, is like, you have to stick out of the crowd, and you have to be something that, that people know is going to be fresh and new and different, for you know, like agencies to take interest in you, because you know, they can book 100, you know, straightforward Americana bands, but something that's a little bit different, that they can spin and market in a different way, is going to be much more appealing.
At the end of the day, it's a business too, and
exactly.
They've got to make their return. So
exactly.
To your point earlier, something to buy into, or yeah. believe in what you're doing. Get those folks on your team. And so was the agency in charge of promotion as well, or how'd you go about promoting a tour in Europe?
Yeah. yeah, they handled promotion. They had an in-house PR team that we ended up having to pay. I mean, I think when you get on a big label, that they will handle your PR, but I don't even really think that exists anymore. I think, you know, if you're going to do this on your own, or even do it on a label, because so many labels are a la carte now, that mm-hmm. just expecting to pay for your publicity is something that you should not only think about, but insist upon, because your like Facebook ads and your events can only take you so far. And that was a really hard thing for a lot of us in the band to come around to, because I think when you're a broke musician, it's really easy to feel like you're throwing that money away
right.
to some like guy up in a high tower that's, you know, like sending emails. Like, what it's just really hard because it's not a one-to-one transaction.
Totally.
And it's possible that you could be wasting money, and you probably always will. But for that one reviewer that gets a hold of your record and gives you a great review, or gives you really good placement, or, you know, says yes to debuting one of your tracks, it then becomes completely worth it. So, So we paid them to do that. They got us reviews in, you know, music magazines that we would have never known existed, you know, and blogs. They got us radio interviews and, you know, people that would come out to review our shows. And I've known friends that have booked European tours on their own, and that's something that I've never seen them also be able to pull off, because how would you know? Like, it's hard enough to find press in Denver, you know, let alone like some like rural town in, you know, East Germany. So, that was a really important part of it. And it really helped us.
For sure. And how do you go about vetting PR then? Were you pretty hands-on with that process, or what was the evaluation like?
No, I would say because it was in-house, we just kind of had to just like close our eyes and cross our fingers and say, like, and, you know, and not working with this agency before and not really knowing and not really having any other options, but we knew that we wanted to go to Europe and we knew that we weren't going to get there on our own. We just kind of closed our eyes and hoped for the best in that sense. I would say for PR over here, like, we knew that the agent that we hired had worked with, you know, high level bands and was doing a lot of press in LA and had really great contacts, so that definitely helped. But I think a lot of it is just blind faith and having to be okay with the fact that you might make a mistake and you might hire a team that doesn't get you anything. And it's so that, again, that's so hard because it's so dependent on so many different things. Like, it's not, if you don't get any press from like a publicity run that you hire, it may not be because they're not doing their job. It may be because the people that they pitched to have too many submissions. It may be because the people that they pitched to don't like your music. It may, you know, it could be a million different things, and there's really no kind of transparent way to like place the fault or the credit on anyone. So it's probably like one of the biggest gambles with like your independent music money. But when it pays off, it's the thing that will get you the most traction fastest.
Totally. So I have a quick segment here before we wrap up.
Yeah.
Or actually, I got two segments. Okay. But this is the Get Stumped section. So I'm just going to rapid fire to give you a little bit of a break.
All right.
I'm going to give you an either or. And off the cuff, you're just going to let me know what you think. So Stevie Nicks or Patti Smith?
Oh my God. What? This is like Sophie's Choice is what you should call this. Stevie Nicks.
Aretha Franklin or Ella Fitzgerald?
Aretha Franklin.
George Harrison or Tao Wynn?
George Harrison. Oh God, I'm sorry.
Singing or songwriting?
Singing.
And what is your favorite form of love to write about?
Unrequited.
Nice. No hesitation. That was awesome. And then the question that we kind of start to wrap everything up with, which also will probably open up to anything that you wanted to touch on that you didn't get a chance to. The big one is, why do you make music?
Because I couldn't live doing anything else.
And then what do you hope people get out of your music?
Optimism. I would say I hope that they get an idea that they have control of their own lives and that it can be different than how it is if they want it to be.
What inspires you to write then? Is it wanting to convey that sense of optimism, or do you think that just kind of comes through in the way that you write?
The thing that inspires me to write is the idea that I do best in leading by example. And I've always been much better at showing people how to do something than I have been at telling. So I like to use my life as kind of the teacher.
That's awesome. With the band, is it primarily the two leads, the two of you, and then you bring it and arrange it, or how does that work?
Yeah. Usually I'm not a super good collaborator in the traditional sense. Like the idea of sitting down with someone and being like, let's write a song is terrifying to me. And I always hope that I would get over it, but sometimes you just have to accept that that's how you are.
Right.
So the way that we work best is that we will bring, you know, kind of like the bones of a song. And sometimes it's fully complete and we work through it from there. But the way that I like to do it the best is to bring like just a, you know, just a shell of a song and say like, this is what I want. These are the melody lines I want to hit. You know, here's where we go to the chorus. And then just see, you know, what everyone else can kind of fold in. Those are the moments that I've been the most proud of, because it's so cool to see, you know, the, sitting in your living room with a out of tune guitar demo, and how much different it sounds to, you know, the full sound when you have a room full of collaborators adding things in. But that structure has to be there for me, because I can't get lost in kind of the minutiae and like the, you know, the giant amoeba that is like, what is a song? That structure has to be there. And then you kind of like build the human around it.
Totally. And then if you could say something to your younger self when you first knew, like, I'm going to do this music thing, what piece of advice do you think you'd give?
Oh, man. I would say, well, it's like a 5-part answer. But the first thing I would say would be to relax and just let things happen how they need to happen, and not force not try to force either who you are, what you want, or what you're doing, but to just show up with confidence and faith in your talent and what you're doing, and lead with that, and then chill out. Like, just chill out. Go lay down. That's my advice.
Go lay down. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much for coming through and doing this. It was a wonderful sitting down and chatting with you, and super excited to see what the future of the band is looking like. Congrats on your latest show. I'm excited to see what's next. And I guess, where can people find yourself and then the band on?
Yeah. Online? So you can find us at vaudevilleetiquette.com. It's a very hard band name to spell, and we understand that. So you can also VE band directs to that as well. And Google is really good at helping you. Yeah. And you know, we're on all the things, Facebook, Instagram, and all that jazz.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, cheers.
That was Vaudeville Etiquette's new single, Fever Dream, out on all major platforms right now, so be sure to go support them. I truly, truly do really love that song. Shouts out to Taylor again for coming on to Made for Music and sharing her story. As always, if you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. Truly appreciate that extra effort, and I will see y'all next time.